Episode 4. Spectrums. I would not have identified as being on the spectrum. I would not have identified as being on any spectrum. Not a neurodivergent spectrum, not a gender spectrum, not a sexuality spectrum. Obviously, that doesn't mean I wasn't on a spectrum. A black and white picture doesn't prove that there was no color in the past. It just shows something about the lens of the camera taking the picture. And my lens as a child did not include spectrums. I lived in a world of black and white decisions. Things were either good, God approved, or they were bad, of the devil. You listen to the spirit, or you listen to the enemy of God, the natural man. Choices were either aligning you with God or they weren't. People were either ready to be obedient to God or they were wicked and worldly and probably obedient to Satan. There was no thought, action, relationship, or mental playground that did not show up as either one side of this tug of war or the other. 50 Shades of Grey, I thought, were a myth, a deception of Satan to overcomplicate life and justify sin. There was just a single climbing line of exponential growth from baptism into eternity, and all I had to do was not fall off. Life was a true or false test, and I was 100% committed to always and ever being true. That said, I was also a reverent disciple of color. There was no box of crayons big enough, no painting vivid enough, no garden varied enough, and no 90s sweater wild enough for me. This made for a fantastic introduction to my first elementary school classroom at 8 years old. Spangled banners of numbers, pictorial glyphs of letters, vibrant pictures of animals, and picture books were everywhere. And of course, my teacher wore a wild 90s sweater. There were so many colors. I had been homeschooled for years, and at home, the boldest colors were found in my toy box, or in a coloring book, or maybe in the chips aisle at the grocery store. But here at school, I was surrounded by color. I wore iridescent pigtail baubles and a bright yellow shirt, and pink tights for my first day. I hung up my purple backpack, and at my desk, I brought out boxes of colored pencils, colored notebooks, and Lisa Frank folders and placed them next to the colorful nameplate taped on my desk. And they matched. Or rather, they were all at full saturation, which to me amounted to the same thing. I bounced my legs with joy. My teacher was so nice, and sunlight streamed through the windows. This place was made for me, I thought. The classroom wasn't the only colorful thing at school, though. There were also my classmates. They wore real jean jackets and sometimes pastel-colored polos with pleated skirts. They wore their hair in different styles. They didn't tie their hair into pigtails, and they didn't use iridescent baubles. It was all sleek-looking braids and barrettes for them. They painted their nails in vivid blue and ornamented their backpacks with tiny toys. On the first day, they asked me what my favorite color was, and I said pink, and the whole class laughed. It was the beginning of something, but I wasn't sure what. I couldn't articulate these differences. I couldn't tell what made these single braids good and double pigtails bad, but I could tell that there were differences, and I could tell that they mattered. They also spoke different. They didn't talk about church, they didn't talk about God or Jesus or duty or obedience, and they didn't seem to organize their lives around commandments or covenants or going to BYU someday either. "This is because your classmates are worldly," said my parents. "And you must be in the world, but not of the world. You must be in school with worldly classmates without becoming like them. But they'll recognize the light in your eyes and the glow of your countenance, and eventually they will become converted because it will just be so obvious that life as a Mormon is better. So I learned to look different. But it was more than that. I also didn't eat the same food that my classmates ate. Every day they lined up for lunch and I pulled out a lunchbox. Every day they ate school foods, pizza, tacos, sloppy joes, lasagna, chili. And they could complain about it or criticize it because it was just school food, am I right? But every day I had the same thing, ham sandwich, potato chips, Hostess cupcake. And I couldn't complain because I made it myself, exactly the same and exactly the way I liked it. I actually envied the freedom to complain sometimes, and I wondered if rolling my eyes at cafeteria food could buy me acceptance. But when it came down to it, lunch from home was more wholesome, even more righteous, and cheaper too. I must learn to provide for myself by making my own lunch, and I must learn not to rely on government handouts like school lunches. I never was clear on whether I didn't get school lunch because it was too expensive or not expensive enough, but either way, I learned to eat alone. My classmates used words I didn't know, too. Not just slang, but other words. I had been warned by my parents not to learn unknown words from my classmates. The kids at school, they said, will use words that you don't know. Don't copy them. Those are swear words. We're not going to tell you what those words are, but you'll know which ones they are because they will drive away the spirit. You must keep your language pure and clean. You must not be like the kids at school. They spoke nostalgically of times when parents would scrub out a child's tongue with a bar of soap or make them hold it in their mouth as a penalty for swearing. Teachers and parents don't do that anymore, they said, but that just means that you must be careful. You must keep yourself separate, they said. You must keep yourself clean and pure as a vessel for the Lord, and swearing is sinful and dirty. The Lord loves clean language. So there were dirty words. They were so dirty that even using them accidentally could taint me on the inside too. So I must not copy those words. Oh, and sometimes they added, even normal sounding words were used to communicate dirty ideas, and I must not copy those either. They wouldn't give me the examples. I would know, they said, because the spirit would depart from me when those dirty ideas were present. And if I was to remain a valiant example of the gospel for my classmates, as Jesus wanted, then I must stop up my ears to both the use of foul language and foul ideas. It was hard to know which words would make me dirty, and it was hard to know which ideas would be worse. It made me very, very nervous to think that I was always only a few syllables away from angering Jesus so much that he would abandon me in this new place. And the only thing worse than being abandoned by my classmates was to be abandoned by my classmates and by God. So I learned to avoid talking to the other kids. I learned to keep quiet. I made a small room in my mind where I could stay clean from the pollutions of the world. When my classmates began talking of something exciting, something new, something they had seen on TV, something they wanted to talk about in whispers, I learned to leave, to sit alone, to excuse myself to the bathroom, or to just be by myself. I thought I was staying clean. My classmates just thought I was weird. I didn't talk, they whispered to each other. Why doesn't she talk? Is she dumb? Is she retarded? Is there something wrong with her? Oh, no, she's just Mormon. Oh. I never contradicted them. I was proud of being Mormon, or at least I used to be, before I heard it said like that. When the kids at school said Mormon, it didn't really sound like they were impressed or curious about the light in my eyes. It sounded like they were mentioning some accident in the bathroom that they were hoping somebody else would go and clean up. I tried to change their opinions by sending my Mormon glow of righteousness at them, and by not swearing or not copying any of their words, but it didn't seem to work. The kids knew celebrities and TV shows that I had never heard of either. I talked about church leaders and a prophet in Salt Lake City and about temples and missions and how I wanted to have a big family someday. I thought everyone wanted that. I thought everyone got magazines with pictures of these things. I thought everyone had framed pictures of men in suits and temples in their house. My classmates, though, raised their eyebrows. They shook their heads. They said they'd never heard of them. They said they sounded boring. They said they sounded lame. And then they turned to each other and they spoke of their own heroes. The Spice Girls, Britney Spears, Backstreet Boys, Michael Jordan. I didn't know any of them. But since my parents and Sunday school teachers weren't talking about them, they must be the wrong people to like, I thought. So I never asked. I was intentionally non-curious. I worked at not liking anything that my classmates liked. But I remembered the names, and I pinned those syllables to the bulletin board of my mind to remind me of what was forbidden. The kids knew social moves that I didn't know. Tricks and puns, covert eye glances, passed notes, songs and rhymes. I was an easy target, and soon everyone was passing around names and notes and giggling behind their hands as I passed by. I spent less and less time in the colorful classroom and more time in the bathroom, locked in a stall and waiting as long as possible before going back to class. Why does she go to the bathroom so much? Ugh, what is wrong with her? She's just so weird. She was homeschooled. Cringe. Our school probably did have counselors. Most schools do. But I never asked. Even if I had known about counselors, though, I wouldn't have asked. I didn't tell anyone about the whispers. I assumed this was just part of the worldliness of school. I assumed that this is what everyone experienced at school, or at least what every other Mormon experienced. And if my Sunday school lessons had taught me anything about worldly persecutions, it was that they were necessary and refining and unavoidable if you were a true disciple. And God was pleased with followers who could suffer and be persecuted without complaining. So I didn't complain. I didn't tell my teacher. I didn't ask for help. Sandbagging against the deluge of worldliness, though, was exhausting. I was the only Mormon, but I wasn't the only kid struggling. Other kids in my class struggled too, and they were also bullied. There was a boy named Kyle who never seemed to say the right things. Kyle had dark hair and teeth that pressed outward and also very pale skin. He did unusual things with his arms. He sometimes hit the desk. Sometimes another grown-up would come to sit with him, and sometimes he hit the other grown-up. He spoke too loudly and often at the wrong times. He didn't seem to understand the giggles and the notes either. And I didn't understand Kyle. It would be another couple of decades before I first reflected on Kyle and realized that he was probably on at least one spectrum. But for me as a child, he just looked lonely. He wasn't invited to play. He wasn't picked for teams. People leaned away and rolled their eyes and covered their ears when they were next to him. They complained when they were assigned to sit with him. And I wanted to be different. I wanted to glow like Jesus, and Jesus loved everyone, and I had been baptized. I knew I had supernatural boosters to be like Jesus, so I tried to be nice to Kyle. I said hello to him, and I smiled at him, and one time I gave him a packet of fruit snacks for my lunch. I didn't know if that mattered to him, but I figured that being left out hurt him just like it did me, and at least he didn't swear or talk about Spice Girls. Soon after, I realized this was a mistake. I had crossed an invisible line. I had broken an unspoken rule. I had done something bad. I started hearing a new song from my classmates. K-I-S-S-I-N-G, they sang. I didn't hear the rest of the words, but when I did, I went redder than the apples and the A's of our classroom. My classmates had made a song, I thought, a song about me, a song about me and Kyle in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G. It took me a bit to work out what they were spelling. I had to write it on a piece of paper to read it for myself. And then I was so embarrassed. So embarrassed. I tore up the paper and almost threw it away. But throwing away paper was bad. It hurt the planet, so I recycled it instead. I went home and told my parents that my classmates were singing about me and that it made me uncomfortable. They laughed. "Oh, that song has been around forever," they said. "It's just something kids do." "But what do I do?" I asked. "Well, who is singing the song?" they asked. "Mostly a group of boys from my class," I said. "Ah," they said knowingly, looking at me sideways in an inscrutable way. "Then that means they like you. They probably think you're cute." The way they said this sounded dirty. "They just like you. They think you're cute. Be careful. No dating until you're 16. And then I stopped asking questions. This seemed to be their final word on the discussion, and it gave me nowhere to go. I saw no kindness in the boys' sneering, and I felt no joy from their finger pointing. This wasn't the type of liking that I had ever witnessed before, and it felt as invasive and as dangerous as all of the dirty words combined. But what could I do? Nothing, apparently. They just liked me, and that meant that the problem wasn't something I could fix through action. It was something that had gone wrong through being. I hadn't caused the problem with fruit snacks, I realized. I was the problem. So I wasn't embarrassed anymore. Now it was deeper. Now I realized there was something else causing the problem. Something more foundational. Something I couldn't control. Something inside me. I realized it was me that was the problem, and now I was ashamed. I got quieter, and things at school got worse. There were more notes, more singing, more pointing, more giggles. I started avoiding Kyle. That was difficult because the teacher had placed us next to each other, seeing as I was one of the only kids in class who didn't complain about Kyle's arms and sounds. She had said this was a compliment. She could trust me to be nice to him. My classmates said it was a sign of K-I-S-S-I-N-G. I didn't know anything about birds or bees or baby carriages or how K-I-S-S-I-N-G in a tree related to those things, but I could tell from the way that my classmates sang the song that it was bad, that it was dirty, that it was definitely not something Jesus would approve of. And I could tell from the notes that they shoved towards my desk while the teacher wasn't looking that this was the kind of worldliness that I must be very careful of. And I could tell from the pointing fingers that it was all my fault. So I told no one. I threw away the notes. I pretended not to care. I ran to the edge of the schoolyard at recess to hide behind a tree. I talked little and I listened less. I leaned away from Kyle. I pretended not to hear him if he spoke to me. I didn't smile at him anymore. I looked away when people looked at me. I left class as often as I could to go to the bathroom and hide. I tried to sponge my mind of anything except pluses and minuses and true and false quizzes and spelling tests. Then I began to spell words in my mind as they left someone's mouth, just to get away from what they were saying. If I was busy spelling what they said, I couldn't be as hurt by what they were actually saying. Or at least that's how it started, I think. But it quickly became a coping mechanism, a compulsion. I spelled everything, anything, staring at the shapes of the letters and the words and chanting them like mantras to anesthetize the school day. "May I go to the bathroom?" B-A-T-H-R-O-O-M. "Ham sandwich for lunch." H-A-M space S-A-N-D-W-I-C-H. "Ugh, why are you so weird?" "Weird. W-E-I-R-D. "Is it because you're Mormon?" M-O-R-M-O-N. I got very good at spelling. One day, though, it all came crashing down. We were asked to color in an American flag and draw 50 little stars on its top left square. 50 stars. I thought, how in the world do I do that? Another classmate started coloring things in. Jessica, across from me, began deftly scribing stars in neat little lines across her flag. I tried to watch her, tried to copy her movements, but I couldn't figure it out. She was too fast. I raised my hand and asked for the teacher. She came and looked over my shoulder. "Just draw the stars," she said. "S-T-A-R-S." I can't, I said. I don't know how. "I thought you liked to draw," she said. "Draw. D-R-A-W. I do," I said, "but..." Silence. I could tell that my teacher had thought I was joking, but that just made it worse. I had never drawn a star, and I hadn't known that was a prerequisite to third grade, so it was just another thing I was bad at, I realized. My teacher caught up quickly, though. "Oh, I see," she said. "You've never done this before." She leaned over to show me. "You go up and down like an A," she said, holding my hand with the pencil inside it. "But don't lift up your pencil. Then we cross up and over, then straight across, then down to where you started." I copied her movements without her hand. "Yes," she smiled, and walked away. I labored over the stars, my face burning. The points were clumsy and irregular. I had never drawn stars before. Why had I never drawn stars before? Maybe I really was stupid. Maybe I really was weird. Maybe the other kids were right. They were all so fast and so neat and so matchy. Why was I so slow? They had all figured this out long before me. And not just the stars. Everything. What was wrong with me? A curly-haired blonde boy with very pink cheeks sat just barely farther than arm's reach away from me. His name was Scott. He liked to eat his pizza with ranch. He and his best friend Todd wrote most of the notes, sang most of the songs, and did most of the pointing. A few years later, when I read about Dudley Dursley for the first time, it would be Scott's face that I saw. I felt Scott's eyes on me as the teacher was showing me how to draw stars, and I was working very hard to pretend that he didn't exist. When our teacher left, he was bent over his desk scribbling across his own paper. And as my teacher sat down at her desk, he leaned towards me, lifting out of his seat to push a folded slip of blue-lined paper onto my desk, right next to my colorful name card. I paused my stars. Scott's eyes were still on me, pressing me towards the slip of paper. I didn't want to open it, but when I didn't read his notes, Scott sometimes would poke me in the side or flick tiny bits of paper to draw my attention until I did. So I put down my pencil. I knew it was bad. Scott and Todd were already snickering and grasping hands quietly with each other. And what was worse, reading it now or reading it after being spitballed? So I opened it. The tears came all at once. Not a little cry, a big torrent of emotion. Heavy, confused, painful tears. My teacher stood up and called me out into the hallway. Going to the hallway was something that only happened to kids who were in trouble. Bad kids. I was so ashamed. She demanded to know what was wrong. "Was this about the stars?" "It's fine," she said. If you don't finish, you can just take the project home and finish it there." I shook my head and handed her the note. She looked at the clumsy drawing of two faces, one with pigtails and one with dark hair and teeth pressing out. There was an ugly heart between them and a title, "Mr. and Mrs. Retard." Her face creased together. "Who sent this?" she said. "Scott." She called Scott into the hallway. I don't remember what she said, and I don't remember how he responded. My ears were ringing, and I felt the sting of failure. I hated that I was crying at school, and I hated that I was crying in front of Scott. I couldn't look at him. I hated him. And I knew that made me severely, irreversibly worldly. But I couldn't help it. I hunched my shoulders, trying to disappear, while I choked down sobs and punished myself for this show of weakness. So I wasn't worthy, I thought. I hadn't been up to it. I hadn't been strong enough to keep being kind to Kyle in the face of persecution. I hadn't been strong enough to hold the shame in the background. And now I hated Scott and I hated Todd and I couldn't even tell where the hate ended. There was so much. I wanted to run away. I wanted to lock myself in the bathroom forever. I wanted to stop existing. And to me, this all amounted to failure. Failing to be like Jesus. Failing to undo the cruel liking that had happened. Failing my parents. Failing school. Failing everything. It proved that I was desperately, horribly, worldly, and wicked, and not godly. Scott was sent to the principal's office. My teacher took me to an old-fashioned coil-corded phone attached to the wall. She dialed my parents and tucked the phone against her neck. While the phone rang, she turned to me and asked, "Why didn't you tell me?" It was a genuinely new idea to me. My teacher was there to teach, I thought, not to do whatever this was. "I didn't think it was appropriate," I said. And now I was ashamed that I hadn't known that I should tell her. "Oh," the teacher said, her eyes full of pity. "Oh, honey." My mom answered the phone. She heard out the situation. I didn't hear what she said, but later we all met in the office with Scott's parent, and there was a forced apology so that we could reconcile before going back to class. That afternoon, I walked home from school alone and feeling despicable. I had broken my covenant to be like Jesus, I thought, by crying like that and by hating Scott, and I didn't even know how to make sure it didn't happen again. After all, I had somehow made those boys like me, so in essence, this was still all my fault. I prayed in my head and tried to repent, and I tried to think of what I could do to make up the difference to God to be good again. On my way home from school, I always passed an older woman's house. In the autumn, her yard filled up with brown and yellow leaves, and on my way home, I saw her raking them. Her movements were stiff and small. Her white hair spread into the breeze. The rake looked heavy in her thin hands. I walked by slowly, and then I doubled back and offered to help. Maybe, I thought, even if I couldn't be a glowing beacon of the gospel to my classmates, and even if I couldn't love Scott, I could at least love my neighbor. She said her name was Marnie, and that yes, she would really appreciate the help with her leaves, and also thank you, dear. So I dropped my backpack on the sidewalk and grabbed the rake with both hands. The handle felt long and waggled in my grip, but I made up for it with passion. I raked and raked until my shoulders ached. The yard wasn't done, but Marnie told me I ought to go home before my parents worried, and I felt a little better. It felt like penance to rake Marnie's leaves, or rather, more like Mormon repentance. It also just felt good. I liked serving Marnie. Marnie was nice, I thought. Marnie didn't swear or talk about the Spice Girls either. As I walked the rest of the way home, I was also glad that none of my classmates had been there to see me. If fruit snacks led to baby carriages, who even knew what raking leaves could lead to? That night, after my dad got home, my parents asked more questions, and I realized that the process wasn't over. I had to confess the whole thing again, cry again, feel ashamed for hating Scott again. How long had this all been happening? They asked. And why hadn't I told them? I did, I said. You told me they just liked me. Oh, well, obviously that's not what we meant. Oh. You should have told your teacher, they said. That's what normal kids do when something happens in class. N-O-R-M-A-L. Okay, I said. The next day, my teacher switched my seat with Jessica's so that I wasn't sitting next to Kyle. I kept trying to be kind to him, but I didn't share fruit snacks anymore. Scott and Todd still giggled and pointed, but they stopped sending notes, and they stopped singing. Jessica colored the most beautiful map of the United States I had ever seen. Each state seemed to glow in jewel tones. I asked her how she had done that, how she had taken that flat piece of paper and turned it into a collection of glowing shapes. So she taught me, you don't color everything the same, she said. Make the edges darker and then fade the color in towards the center. It's called shading. I kept serving Marnie all through the fall. I brought my mom to rake leaves with us. On trash days, I dragged her bins inside. In the spring, we helped her plant flowers. None of my classmates asked me where the light in my eyes came from, so I didn't get to tell them how they too could be blessed by a prophet in Salt Lake City. But my teacher did ask me once in a while if I had gotten more notes and if I was doing okay. I never felt sure if I had passed the test of school. Not the spelling test or the math test, but the bigger test. I never felt quite sure that the notes and the singing and the bullying weren't my fault, or that being liked wasn't a personal defect on my part. I never felt quite sure if I was good or if I had succeeded in staying unsullied by the world. UNSULLIED. Unsullied. But 24 years later, I wanted to find out. I looked up the word autism on the internet, and then the word religious OCD. Then I searched scrupulosity and binary worldview, and how do I know if I am neurodivergent? After that, I searched environmental factors and LDS Mormon influence on neurodivergence and Mormon scrupulosity and symptoms in childhood. I remembered the boxes of crayons and the safety of the bathroom and the black and white lines in my head. I remembered being alone and pretending not to notice while also scrutinizing the rules that I had learned from classmates and from Jesus. I remembered going silent on the accusation of being cute and the shame that moved into that silence, and my teacher's pity as she said, "Oh, honey." I sighed. I was over 30 years old. But there in front of that screen felt like the first time since the first day that the third grader inside me could breathe. I thought it was righteousness. I thought it was worldliness. I thought it was a true or false test, a good and bad tug of war. I thought I was either good or bad. But finally, all those years later, I exhaled. Finally, all those years later, I could stop wondering if it was actually all my fault. Finally, all those years later, I stopped being ashamed. There were more tears to cry, but I followed the beacon of search results through page after page of explanations. I followed the clear lines of logic going up, down, across, over, down. It was all spelled out. ADHD. OCD. ASD. Oh, it was such a relief. I didn't really understand the letters. I didn't know if I should be wearing some of them, or if Kyle had been wearing some of them, or if my parents wore them, or Scott. But they did help me be kind to my memories of them. They did help me stop the incessant judging of worldliness and worthiness and goodness. I sat back and crossed my arms, closed my eyes, and hugged that third grade self through the flesh of my own 30-year-old arms. I thought of my own children butting up against their own years in public school. I wondered if they were already wearing some of these letters too, without me knowing it. What if, I thought, I didn't need repentance? What if it was never a true or false test? What if it wasn't a tug of war? What if being alive is not supposed to feel like war? I thought. Ooh, that was new. And then I realized something else. I hadn't needed repentance. I hadn't needed righteousness. And with all due respect to Jesus, he hadn't exactly solved my problems either. I had needed letters, colors, numbers, words. I had needed permission to smile at Kyle, to rake Marnie's leaves, and to see Scott as Dudley Dursley. I had needed accommodations. I had needed someone to talk to. I had needed a teacher who wasn't scared of all these messy letters. Oh, honey, the results said, of course you did. It wasn't your fault. You're not wrong. People are colorful. People are complicated. People aren't just good or bad. The world was never black and white. You are like a big box of crayons, and the world is full of spectrums. Thank you so much for listening. For more information on embodied faith transitions, one-on-one embodiment coaching, or for other support from personal essays and art, please visit laurarandall.com. Obviously, it's not free or easy to write and produce, so if you enjoyed this story, I would be very grateful if you considered buying me a coffee. You can do that at ko-fi.com/embodied faith transition. Your contribution will go directly to funding more episodes, supporting more people in faith transition, and to keeping this podcast ad-free. Thank you so much in advance. You can also support this podcast by leaving a 5-star review or by sharing with a friend. This episode was written, recorded, and produced by me, Laura Randall, and it is based on my own experience growing up and growing out of religion. No AI was used in the writing or editing of this work, and this podcast is not affiliated with any church. To preserve the dignity and anonymity of others who have intersected with my story, some names or other sensitive details may have been changed. Finally, if this episode has resonated with the artist within you, and you would like to work together or maybe even write one of your own experiences of faith transition into a personal essay, please reach out through the contact tab on laurarandall.com. Until next time, I'm wishing you every blessing.